I'm Heidi Zuckerman. I've spent my life connecting people to art to make their lives better. This podcast talks about art in contemporary culture and why we should care. Each episode is an impactful conversation with people I find interesting and think you will too, about their life, values, and always about why they think art matters. This is Conversations About Art. Hey everyone, one of my favorite things about this podcast is getting to talk to people that I've never met before, but whose careers or practices or lives seem really interesting to me. And that, in fact, is the premise of this entire podcast, to talk to people who I find interesting and who I think you will too. I was definitely right with Rebecca Ann Proctor. She has a fascinating story and is great, not only at telling her story, but telling the story of others that she's met along her journalistic and art journey. I know you're really going to enjoy this podcast, and we'll get to it in just a minute. I don't know about you, but I get most of my things done in the spaces between doing everything else, and I gravitate towards the things I can handle from an app on my phone. Kelly Klee Private Client Insurance believes that people with more to lose need better protection for what they cherish. I have insured not only my cars and homes with them, but also my personal art collection. They have an incredibly well-designed app that's not only aesthetic, but the user interface is superb. I can see each work in my collection and its currently insured value, as well as seamlessly and easily, literally from my phone, add new things as they're acquired. Insurance to me sounds like kind of a boring thing to talk about, but particularly in these uncertain times, I sleep way better at night knowing that the things I love are protected. So check out their website, kellyklee.com/Heidi. That's kellyklee.com/Heidi, and they will make a $50 donation to Artadia, an art charity I've recommended, per each qualified referral. These details are included in the show notes. Is there a piece of jewelry you would like to create? I'm excited to tell you about Best & Co., which offers a smarter way to acquire luxury jewelry. I wanted to create signet rings for each member of my family. Best & Co. worked with me to create a custom design and fabricate the rings. We all love them. The rings are a daily and physical reminder of our connection, even when we're not together. Whether you want to reuse sentimental stones from a family heirloom or create a piece that you have been dreaming about, Best & Co. can help you create it, and their effective and efficient business model allows them to provide significant savings to their clients. Clients regularly save as much as 30%, and frequently more, when compared with purchasing comparable, high-quality pieces from traditional luxury jewelry retailers. So check out their website, www.bestincoaspen.com, and use discount code Heidi2020 to receive 5% off of any item on Best & Co.'s website. I was just looking at it today, and honestly, there are a ton of things that I would like to use that discount code for. Also, if you're interested in creating a custom piece, you can email custom@bestincoaspen.com. That's bestandcoaspen.com, and mention that you heard about Best & Co. on my podcast to receive the special discount. Rebecca Ann Proctor is a journalist, presenter, and consultant who writes on culture, cultural policy, contemporary affairs, international relations, the art market, art exhibitions, critical art reviews, luxury, fashion, food, hotels, and travel for Arab News, ArtNet News, The Forward, Frieze, Vogue Arabia, Wallpaper, The National, Gallery Magazine, T Emirates, The New York Times Style Magazine, Bloomberg Business Week, the BBC, and many others. In April 2018, she moderated a panel at the Culture Summit in Abu Dhabi on emerging trends in the arts and media worldwide. And in March 2018, she appeared as a judge on Fashion Star Season 3, Reem Akra's hit reality TV series for emerging Arab fashion designers in Beirut. She's also advised numerous artists, galleries, architects, and art collectors in the MENA and African regions. She and I discuss having a quote-unquote glamorous life, not knowing what to call yourself, art as a means to know what is going to happen, cultural crossroads, the creativity of the edge, trying to find order, the work of Marwan Sharmarani, how trauma impacts artwork, art as documentation, trusting your gut, how to work things out, the beauty of being imperfect, the role of empathy, what we took for granted, and how art cannot lie.
I was just thinking about the fact that I am waking up. It's 7 a.m. here, and you are at the end of your day, 7 p.m. in Dubai. And I saw you on video briefly, and you look great. You're all dressed for the day. And I'm still in what people sometimes wear to Zoom meetings at home early in the morning.
I don't know. We have like a Zoom outfits. In my former life, pre-COVID, you know, I was always getting dressed up and going out to events and stuff like that. And now I'm, you know, I just sort of, yeah, I dress up as much as I can for sort of like, you know, just my upper half of my body. And the rest is sort of just, you know, between yoga pants and dance clothes. I'm a dancer on the side. So I'm sort of between my work at home and going to dance class and rehearsals. So that's just basically my wardrobe at the moment.
It's so funny because I remember a few years ago, now it's like 5 or 6 years ago, my son did one of his boarding school interviews on, I don't think it was Zoom, you know, but it was some kind of like, you know, video interview. And he didn't want to wear pants. You know, he just wanted to wear like the coat and tie. And I said, you know, Emerson, you have to wear pants because I heard this thing once that like sometimes in a video interview, they ask you to stand up. And he was like, they're not going to do that. And sure enough, they did. And luckily he was wearing pants. But now, you know, that's become sort of a funny thing, right?
Yeah, we're in a whole new world. But I don't know, I just sort of take every day as it comes, basically. It's a whirlwind. We're still in it, but I do feel that we're nearing the end, which is good.
Absolutely. There are certain people who I feel like have really glamorous lives. At least it sounds like they do. And it seems to me like you are one of them. So we can
just from talking to me right now or from what you've sort of read about me or heard about me?
From my research, yes. Not from necessarily just this morning. But I wanted to ask you to tell our listeners where you are and where you live first and then what you do.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on your podcast, Heidi. My name is Rebecca Ann Proctor, and I am a journalist and an art consultant, and I'm going to put dancer there too now, and I'm based in Dubai. I'm American. I'm originally from Connecticut, but we moved with my family to Rome when I was 16. My mom's a painter, and my father is a retired professor of Italian literature, so he's written numerous books on sort of Roman and Renaissance I'd say philosophical thought and heritage. And my mom has had many shows, but they're completely American, but we've had this special dialogue relationship with Italy. My parents met in Italy, and my brother and I, since we were young, we've been going to Venice every summer. And that sort of has been a huge part of my life. You know, I'm not Italian, but I speak Italian. And so I moved to Rome when I was 16 and I went to international school, and I just, I really hit it off with all the kids there. They were, you know, from just all various backgrounds, mostly diplomats, but also some sort of film director kids. And it was just such an great international world. And I was supposed to go home to the States and go to college, but I was just so happy I stayed in Rome. And then I ended up doing my master's, doing a master's in London. Well, I had finished my ballet degree. Well, on the side, I've always had dance as well. I finished my ballet degree at the same time in Rome with the Royal Academy of Ballet. So I was sort of torn between what to do, dance or continue school. And I had been professionally doing as a ballerina, been dancing. but I had been accepted to a master's in art history in London, and so in contemporary art history. So I moved to London to do my master's after Rome. And that was a big switch because I was studying Renaissance and ancient art in Rome, and then I suddenly was studying modern contemporary art. And I stayed there for a year. I had an internship, a year-long internship that turned into sort of a job with Gagosian Gallery. But I wasn't quite ready, I think, to sort of enter sort of the cutthroat art world. I was only 20, 21, 22 at the time. And I had deferred from another master's program in conflict resolution and international relations in Paris. And it was a master conjoint, which meant that you did it in French and English. And I've always loved languages. So I just decided to go and study more. You know, at one point my dad was like, you just keep studying. Are you going to work, Rebecca? But, you know, everything kind of came together and I moved to Paris. And this is kind of where I segue into the Middle East. I had this course with a professor called Ali Ranema, an Iranian professor on the political economy of the Middle East. And I just completely fell in love. You know, it was post 9/11 and I just became obsessed with the Middle East. I mean, that wasn't really art related. It was more just sort of culture and heritage and history. And I went to Beirut in 2007 for the first time. That was right after the Israeli invasion. And I literally fell in love. I don't know what it was. It was some sort of, amazing connection, but I just needed to go back and live. And so I jumped, right after I finished my master's in Paris, I moved to Abu Dhabi. I got a job at a gallery. It was an ancient art gallery. Actually, the dealer there is one of the biggest dealers of ancient art in the whole world. Fayez Barakat. He's a very colorful character. You might know of his gallery on Rodeo Drive. I think it still exists there. And that was sort of my segue into the Middle East. I stayed there for a year and then I was always doing I was doing writing journalism on the side. I'd started writing for Business of Fashion. I've done, from fashion to lifestyle to art, culture, and also politics. I've done a lot of different writing and reporting. And I never thought I'd become such a journalist or such an editor. But, after I, was doing a lot of that writing on the side, I got my first magazine job in the UAE. And that led to a variety of other gigs. I edited the New York Times Style magazine in Dubai and then worked for Bloomberg Middle East. And then right when I was about to leave Dubai, I got a job with Harper's Bazaar. And that was really amazing. I was there. I was the editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar Art and Harper's Bazaar Interiors for around 5 or 6 years. And that was really, it was an incredible job. And I guess that's where I segue into the glamorous lifestyle, because it was glamorous, but the glamour is not always what people think it is. And I think I want to say that so openly, because yes, I have all beautiful dresses and I went to beautiful cocktails and traveled to Monaco and to Venice for the film festival and, to Basel for art fairs and incredible dinners with incredible people. And it's an incredible lifestyle, but it was just, it's nonstop. And I edited this magazine. It got a lot of, people really, really loved it around the world. It was sort of, I focused mostly on the Middle East. Then I got really into Africa. I was doing a lot of Harper's Bazaar art, dedicated to Africa. And it was, getting a lot of international recognition and it was really fulfilling, but I wasn't, I was doing it for the artists. I mean, for the people there, because a lot of the stories from the Middle East and from Africa really haven't been told enough, I think, to the West and to the rest of the world. And then, the pandemic, I had thought last year that I would actually move to London. I thought I would kind of do half the year in Dubai and half the year in London and live closer to my parents. And they live in Liguria in Italy. And then the pandemic hit and I had left Harper's in November 2019. It was very difficult to leave the job, but I just felt it was time to move into other things. I started doing a lot of presenting and I just, I thought it was time for a change. And it was. And then the pandemic hit and I couldn't do the move. And so I've stayed here in Dubai and I'm still doing a lot of reporting, a lot of consulting. I've obviously done a huge amount of consulting for Intersect 21, which has been very fulfilling. And, I guess I don't know what to call myself anymore. I'm a journalist / art consultant / dancer. I've gone back to dance in the pandemic, which has been, a huge gift. And yes, I still write about I write a lot about, the politics, the culture and the history that make up the Middle East. And that's been challenging at times for the very complex layered history of this region, but it's extremely rewarding because I don't think a lot of the stories get told enough abroad. I think people have a lot of misconceptions about the Middle East. They see it just as, a place where explosions take place and wars happen, but it's so rich and varied. I feel like I just rambled that off, but yes.
Well, I knew I was right. And I think there's often a perception reality gap in and around the art world, often with women in significant roles. And as you also just ended by saying, with what people understand about Israel and the Middle East. And I think through conversation and through dialogue, people can share individual stories. And with those individual stories, you can get a little bit more, even if only one more person's perspective, but on the truth of the circumstance.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And it's something that I conceptually think about a lot. You know, why do I tell these stories? You know, why are these stories important? I think any journalist who's really sort of deep into their craft and to what they do will think about that, particularly in this region. Because this region, unfortunately, is, you know, there's a lot of revisionism, you know, in terms of history. And it's because of it, you know, these are ancient lands. I mean, every land is ancient, but there's just been, you know, Iraq is still referred to as the cradle of civilization, you know, Mesopotamia. I mean, if you look at Armenia, you know, I had to report on the Nagorno-Karabakh, what was happening, the war there. And that was what, around October, I spent 5 weeks in Beirut just after the explosions. And that was a really tough story because both sides see the history of Armenia in a very different way. The history of, you know, Azerbaijan versus Armenia. And it's people believe that, you know, it's the same with Palestine and Israel. And as a writer, it's really difficult because the Israelis and the Jews will probably sometimes, some of them, again, I don't want to, I really try not to generalize, but they'll have a different story and perception than the Palestinians. And so when you're telling these stories, you have to be so careful, and you tell them, and you tell them and you quote the people that you've interviewed. But I guess what I've realized is, you know, and now I'm going to get a little bit philosophical, but oftentimes truth is subjective. And I think we've realized that during the pandemic, there's always another truth. And, you know, and it kind of comes down to a lot about emotions and history. And that's why I love art, because I find writing about art and looking at the art, sometimes, even though I am a writer and I'm, you know, a speaker or conversationalist, whatever have you, sometimes the art actually has the most truth, because you really feel the pulse of the emotions. You know, I mean, there is one of my, I actually refer to him as sort of a mentor, but he's a curator based in Palestine. And I remember years right before the Arab Spring started, he said, "But Rebecca, you know, just look at the canvases of some of the artists in the Middle East, the Arab artists, just look at the canvases right now." And it was, you know, 2011, things were kind of boiling up, and the brushstrokes were heavy. They were violent. They were passionate. They were, you know, and he said, "You can just tell from the art that something's about to happen." And so I think that's really interesting, you know?
It's super interesting. And I'm in a new place now. And as I'm working to figure out what to do here and how to collaborate and how, honestly, to lead, I am learning about who was here before and what they valued, and trying to get some insight into the decisions that were made. And you find that people are really invested in not just their histories, but in their views of those histories. And the geographies that you're talking about maybe have more politicized histories, but every place really has those histories, right? And has often, I think, a disparity of perspectives.
Yes, I mean, definitely. And I think, you know, I have to moderate another talk on, is it on Monday? Gosh, I've sort of had a marathon of talk moderations, but it's about, you know, conflict in art. And I've never done this before, but we've actually, the talk is going to include two artists from the Middle East, one from Lebanon and one from Palestine, and then two artists, African-American artists. One is Ethiopian kind of American artist. And yes, I mean, you know, the U.S. has just recently gone through an extremely violent year, you know, and I think with the Black Lives Matter movement and what's happening in terms of race and stuff, and it's all exploded. And that in itself, there's sort of some revisionism. There's some, you know, challenges, as you're saying, between sort of place and truth and what happened. And there's still anger, you know, there's a lack of resolution from the past, and hopefully it is resolving. So I'm going to obviously put them in dialogue. I think it will be a bit of a challenge, but I hopefully will get some interesting ideas, you know, to come out of that. But I very much agree with you. I think that there's always layers to a place and to a history.
If people ask the question of me that they're most curious about, it relates to my curatorial practice and how I've made the decisions that I've made, how I've chosen the artists that I've chosen. And I would ask that question of you in terms of stories. And I know it's slightly different if you're in the role as an editor and you're being assigned certain stories, or if you are assigning stories or choosing your own stories. But what do you think catches your interest? How have you made some of the choices about what you've spent your time researching, learning about, writing about?
Well, I always love this question because I think I'm organically sort of drawn to thing to you know, you're sort of, it's not that sometimes I'm not necessarily searching for a story. I realized that when I was putting together the magazine with Harper, some people said, "Oh, well, aren't you afraid? Don't you freak out before every issue and you think, what am I going to put there?" And you just find yourself that it does come naturally. I mean, obviously you're reading a lot of news and you're going to fairs, you're going to design fairs, you're meeting people. So you get sort of ideas and one idea kind of moves into the next. But what I really love is the edge, the stories around the edge, the stories around the border. And that sort of, I think, has characterized my work. I love looking at stories and, yeah, cultural borders, cultural crossroads. I mean, Dubai technically is a cultural crossroad. It's always been a sort of a port city, I mean, for centuries, really. And it's a hodgepodge of different cultures. And the same with, I'd say, sort of, you know, I got really into East Africa. I mean, East Africa, which hasn't actually ever really been explored through an exhibition, but it's something that I'd love to do. But East Africa has this relationship with the Gulf because of its proximity. And so there's a lot of interesting crossovers, not just, you know, you can look at the way that people, you can look at some of the African Saudis, because I've been doing a lot of work in Saudi. They have the same sort of characteristics or features as the East Africans. Some of them, obviously, some of them have come from Sudan and whatnot. And there's a lot of histories and crossovers. And that's where I find that's where I get a lot of my ideas from. And it can come from mixed, it can come from mixed disciplines. It can be mixed race. It can be, you know, I think the edge, you know, I've always loved the word the edge, but I think that's where a lot of creativity lies. And I think that's where there's a lot of exploration to do. And I've always done that with the magazine. I sort of like to put, you know, from, it could be South Asian, you know, kind of juxtaposing South Asian with the Gulf, because there's always been a relationship. And the same with fashion, for example. When I was at Harper's, I was always reporting a lot on couture. I mean, before that, I did more with Pret. But couture, too, is sort of on the edge between art and design and obviously high fashion, you know? So that's kind of where I find my stories. But then I also was, when I was traveling, I can't forget that I was sort of, you know, I traveled more than anyone I knew. I mean, I sort of, at the end, I think lockdown was actually quite a good thing for me, because I just really, really needed to stop. I really needed to slow down. But traveling itself is an edgy pastime. You know, you're constantly at the border, at the airport, seeing different people. And, you know, I'm curious by nature. And that's where I would get an idea. Maybe it would be on the plane. Maybe I'd see something, or maybe I'd take a car when I, you know, land in Addis Ababa and I see an interesting church and you see the frescoes might look similar to what a contemporary artist is doing in London. I mean, you know, your mind kind of moves in that direction. And I mean, my travels to Africa over the last few years, I mean, this is what's been, I've missed the most. I just have loved exploring Africa. I think there's so many interesting stories there. I mean, I went to the Congo last January. That was one of my last big trips. And I went to the Lubumbashi, which was just a few months after the biennial finished, but it was just extraordinary. So a lot of these stories, yeah, they come from the edge. They come from sort of cross-cultural dialogue. I'm a big fan of cross-cultural dialogue. I really believe in it. Not just white, black, or, you know, whatever, or Asian or Latino, but, you know, people who come from different cultures, different backgrounds, different classes even, you know. I think I like to put people together in dialogue, but it's really through the travels. I mean, we're obviously having to travel in a different way now, but traveling is just such a source of inspiration. You know, when you can feel a place, when you can feel the pulse of a city and, you know, smell what's happening. You know, I went to Beirut right after the explosions. I mean, I was sort of really, it's been a huge, very important city for me for my whole life. And I just had to be there. And I just, I can't write on something if I don't, I mean, I was writing a lot, obviously, and I know the city, but you need to be there physically, I think, to kind of get the pulse, to feel what's happened, to feel the trauma as well.
I used to travel a lot also. And interestingly, in a sort of random way, I don't know if you remember some years ago when people were sharing their 25 things about them on Facebook, and I really didn't want to do that. I tend to be a private person, though I've spent the last, you know, year doing these conversations, and people probably know a ton more than I ever thought I would have shared, and quarantine became a big part of that. But my number one thing on my 25 things was I travel a lot. And I love traveling, but I hate packing. Packing makes me cry every single time. And I wonder if you have things like that, things that you love about travel, but also things that are uncomfortable, and not uncomfortable in a good way, but uncomfortable in a way that you have to sort of overcome each time you do something.
Yeah, I'm happy to have that question, because I actually struggled with packing myself. You know, the first few years, it was so exciting. I felt so privileged to travel. And I remember when, you know, I was invited to the Venice Film Festival, I planned out my dresses. And of course, you know, you get to borrow dresses, like a designer dress. But then the last few years, it's just become such a task. And it's when you're packing that you feel like you're on the verge of breaking down, especially if you're doing one trip back to back. I remember I was flown into New York for a dinner at the Met, and I was literally in New York City for two nights. And then I had to fly all the way back to Dubai. I didn't even have time enough to see my parents in Connecticut. And just trying to pack for that trip, I was the same. I sort of, it's a weird psychological experience, because it's like you're struggling to kind of keep some sort of sense of order, but then through your suitcase and through your belongings, but then when you end up throwing everything there and just trying to, and hoping that it, you know, and then you hope, you're like, okay, as soon as my suitcase arrives, I'm going to make sense of it all, and hopefully everything will be there. But that's how it kind of, I totally agree. That's what happened. And people don't know. And I have no problem with saying it now, because I think, and I still think people must have thought, and they probably still do think, that I have this incredibly glamorous life with all these beautiful dresses and these posh dinners and stuff. And yes, I did, but they don't know the times when you're in a hotel room and you're there for just 24 hours and you've had no sleep, and you start to cry because you have a magazine that you have to put out to press in a week, and maybe sometimes not enough staff, not enough support, and you feel quite alone, even though you're in probably one of the best and most beautiful hotels in the world, and you have a view out onto the spectacular pool, or, you know, 17th century villa. And that's the truth. That's a sign of irony of this world, of this life. And I think a lot of celebrities must feel similar. People who have this sort of quote, what we call jet set lifestyle. It's really hard to find balance. You know, I'm like I said, I'm a dancer, and I do a lot of, I have to move. I'm a mover. So when I was traveling, it was really difficult to find time to do that. But I would always find that I'm trying to do yoga in the hotel room or Pilates, and that would always kind of calm me down, because you get into this weird, you're like wired all the time, you know, where you're trying to be balanced, but then you need to dash and get your meetings done and get it all finished, you know, and look good at the same time.
Yes, I would just say yes to all of that. It's an honest, very, very honest description of what it feels like sometimes. And travel can be something that, I mean, we're hankering for, right? And as you describe the smells and, you know, the movement of the city as you're passing in a car, or the person, the possibility of who you might be seated next to at dinner, or those things are all exciting. And then, of course, when you come home to the hotel room, right, there is that loneliness associated with it also, and that kind of oddity, right, between like where you think maybe you're supposed to be and where you are, and that gets confusing. And I love your idea of an insight into how packing is about trying to instill order where it's frankly chaotic when you don't have a moment to be grounded. And I like that. That makes sense to me. That gives me some insight as to maybe why it always does make me so sad to have to pack.
Yeah, it is. You know, I remember always trying so hard to find order in my packing. Actually, it's a good way of putting it. And it was just this sort of, yeah, at the end of the day, this pile of these really nice dresses. And I still do these, beautiful design. I love fashion. I love clothes. I mean, I've, you know, growing up in My parents were, they remember, they always tell the story of the first time they bought me these patent leather shoes in Florence, and I was maybe 2 years old, and I screamed when, you know, they were going to buy the shoes, but I screamed when they took them off, and they said, we knew from that day that you would have a issue with clothes. And yeah, I love these beautiful clothes, but I'll never forget just throwing them in this huge Samsonite, you know, bag, suitcase that where I was like, I don't even know what to wear or what to put in. And your emotions go up and down on these trips. You're so excited. You're so inspired. But then you have these lows when you're so tired. And I'm someone that probably like you, I have very high energy. I mean, I can go for a long time without sleep, but then you get a real low and you just crash, you know?
Talk about your dancing. And I also really liked your description about the need to move in hotel room yoga. And I have my yoga mat right now stretched out at the end of my bed in my temporary rental while I wait to move into a permanent home here. And all the pillows that are on my bed are like on top of the yoga mat because it's a small space. But how have you been dancing in the pandemic?
Yeah.
What's your daily life like? Give us a description of that. What are you doing every day now?
I basically move between my home on the Palm Jumeirah. I love my home here. It's Serenia Residences. It's way out on one of the crescents. And we have, you know, I mean, gorgeous views of the Burj Al Arab, and there's the beach, and it's very quiet. I mean, I think I moved out here when I was still at Harper's, and I had this just crazy travel lifestyle. So I would come out and it would just suddenly be quiet and calm. And so I work from home. I do go out and I have to do a lot of reporting, and I do a mix of news reporting and obviously art and culture reporting. I've been reporting at a lot of the hospitals, the test centers. I mean, I even during our lockdown, which was quite intense last year, I went out and I had a special permission to go out on the street. So I work from home and I do my reporting, and then I go to dance. I always knew I was going to go back to dancing. I kind of had to give it up for a few years. I mean, I've always been doing a lot of Pilates on the side, but it's funny, this year sort of has made me, kind of reconciled. Made me refine my dancing, which I knew was always going to come back. I just didn't know how. And so it was actually I started the dance class on Zoom, which was really weird to be dancing in your apartment. I was a ballerina and I hadn't even put my point shoes on for over like 12 years. So, you know, this was all kind of, it was scary. I was actually probably, you know, I'm a very humble person. I don't want to sound like I don't want it to sound pretentious or anything, but I'm quite brave and courageous. I put myself in difficult positions, but I think one of the scariest things for me, even scarier in some ways than going to the Congo, was going back to dance. Cause it was something that I loved so much that I had to kind of, you know, say a temporary goodbye to. And, you know, you go back after so many years and, you know, you're afraid to see, are you still the same level, or are you, can you get back what you've lost? And so I went back on Zoom, and then when the lockdown ended, I just decided I'm going to go to class. And so I started with, you know, the contemporary dance classes at a place called SEMA Performing Arts. And then I started with ballet, and that was in July. And it was in the beginning, it's been a bit difficult. But now I go every day, and I'm even in the rehearsals training for a performance where I've been asked, there's a work that's going to be performed at NYU Performing Arts Center whenever the events can be held. So we're rehearsing. I rehearse about 2 to 3 days a week. And then I have contemporary and ballet almost every other day. And then I'm finishing my Pilates comprehensive exam. I've done all the exams. I mean, I've done this over the last few years, so I have that kind of in the background. I know it's probably sounds extremely eclectic, but that's actually what's keeping me going between working at my computer and doing my writing on various topics. And then I put my dance clothes on, and I'm even, you know, even went back to point work, which was, that was really scary as well. But now I'm getting a lot stronger, and I feel my body feels a lot more fluid, and that makes me so happy. And I, in a way, it helps my writing. It helps the rest of my work. And I'm happy to admit it. I've always been a bit of afraid of these two different sides of myself and how I can reconcile them, sort of the journalist, the intellectual, the sort of fashionable person, whatever, and then the dancer in me. And I've sort of always put the dancer in me aside. But now in this very strange time, I'm both, and sort of one helps the other. And I think that's, and in a way, it's sort of giving me more creative expression. That's what it is. We were going to a lot of events over the Christmas and New Year's. Things, you know, Dubai was probably one of the only cities open in the world. The whole city was just pumped with people. which was a bit scary, but now they've cut the events. And we have to be very careful because cases have gone up, even though there's a huge vaccination drive at the moment. Luckily, there's still these dance classes that are being held. We have to be careful. We wear masks and everything. It's made me very happy during this very strange period. And it's given me a lot more creative freedom and inspiration, I'd say.
What I'm hearing from you is the opportunity now to celebrate, not just acknowledge, but really celebrate what I like to and often refer to as the both and instead of the either or, and the acknowledgement that you can do and be both.
Yes, I think there's, you know, I've always struggled with these, we have these titles, you know, when you're a magazine and you know, I had that fancy title, editor in chief, and you know, and it, yeah, it feels good. It feels powerful. And, or, you know, you, or you, you have a big name, you know, I mean, next to the editor in chief name, you get, you know, Rebecca Ann Proctor or something. But at the end of the day, I've always struggled with how to define myself. And I think there's a lot of people like that who wonder, you know, do we have to define or do we have to have these titles? I mean, yeah, if you're an editor of a magazine, you should have an editor role. Right now I have no title. I mean, I am a reporter. I'm a journalist. That's what I say I am. And I'm also an art consultant. I think it's really inspiring when you can see people, and the art world is filled with that too, where people do, they merge disciplines. And that's, again, that's sort of the edge. That's a kind of also cross-border, right? That's where a lot of creativity springs from, when you merge different things. I mean, I love artists that are multidisciplinary, for example. I mean, I love kind of, you know, artists that use sound or use performance and also have maybe an art piece, a static piece of art. So it's, I think that's where there's a lot of exploration, very much so. And why do we have to always have a title? You know, maybe as human beings, you know, we can become more free to be many things.
I like that. Can you talk about the work of an artist that you're particularly interested in right now, and maybe share the name and describe it so that our listeners have a sense of how you talk about art and think about art and have someone to Google?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, gosh, because I'm working, I work with so many different artists. I'm trying to think of the right one to mention. I'm trying to think of the first one that comes into my mind. I think I might actually just mention Marwan Samarani, because I had he's a painter. He's a Lebanese painter based now out of Tripoli. And I've written a lot in his work. And he just was on a talk I moderated yesterday with Leila Heller and Mohamed Afkami, a big collector here. And Marwan is an abstract expressionist, very much so. He's very prolific in his studio. He keeps going, you know, tons of different paintings. And they, you know, I've seen over the years, from moving between very intense figuration to more sort of abstract qualities in the work, and, you know, using, like I said, thick impasto or maybe not. And I've even seen his experimentation with different colors. When he was living in Spain, the colors were a bit softer, a bit more peaceful. Then moving back to Beirut, you know, they became a bit more violent, a bit more edgy, a bit more feisty. He recently lost his studio in Beirut because of the explosion. And he had a beautiful, beautiful studio and a very, very old house and downtown, and sort of the, is it, I think it is Marwahel. It's one of the neighborhoods that got hit very, very badly. And I have visited it a few times, and it's just magical. He's painting there nonstop, and you get the sense of this old historical building. And it's just, you know, it breaks my heart because they, you know, 2 or 3 seconds, that whole building just exploded, that studio just exploded along with his paintings. You know, he's luckily, and they weren't, some of them weren't so damaged, but he's moving out of Tripoli, which is a port city in Lebanon. It's one of the poor kind of areas, but it's extremely picturesque, and it has an amazing history. I've been there. And yeah, we spoke to him yesterday. I mean, and he's created some extraordinary work during the pandemic. You know, and it's sort of, he was explaining how he works yesterday, and it's sort of, again, what comes, I think, right now. And the idea is just to kind of move forward. He says sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's unconscious, sometimes it's what he sees around him. But again, it's usually within this, an abstract expressionist language. You should definitely Google him, Marwan Samarani. I really love his work. And he's represented at the moment by Leila Heller Gallery in Dubai and New York. But I think, like all Lebanese artists, I'm going to talk about Lebanese artists because I just, you know, they really need the support right now. And, you know, they've lost so much. It's not just the explosion, but they've lost the banking system collapsed. So you can't it's hard for even us to understand unless you're actually there, but they can't actually buy things in the normal way. I mean, the currency is circulating through the black market there. It's just very difficult for artists to even get materials, you know, but there's some brilliant, brilliant artists. There's also Ayman Balbaki. He's another painter, again, works very much in abstract expressionist language, Lebanese, and he's, you know, his work is sold for very high at auction, represented by Saleh Barakat Gallery. I mean, Tigri Darguth is another painter. I'd say that there's just some really great Lebanese artists, but right now they're sort of trapped because they have this very difficult situation where it's not just reeling from the explosion, but reeling from a government that's not doing enough to support them or, you know, heal the country to have reforms so that, yeah, they can get international aid to basically, you know, resurrect the country out of the black hole that they're in. And obviously there's coronavirus as well. There's Hiba Kalash. There's a lot of just wonderful painters. There's just a lot of creativity. I mean, they say, you know, as I'm sure you know just as well as me and other people who will be reading this podcast, that sometimes, you know, trauma, pain creates the best artwork. You know, that can be discussed on a philosophical level forever. But I do find in Lebanon and Iran and some of these places that I've been focusing on for a while, that the work is just extremely strong. And I don't think enough people in the US really, really know, are familiar with some of the Lebanese artists or even the Iranian artists. I mean, the whole Middle East is very rich with different artists, but these are just the ones that come to my mind first because I've been working and, you know, writing about them recently. And African artists, I mean, I could go on and on. There's just some amazing, amazing artists that I've worked with over the last few years. I mean, I just can't even, Henry Abrams, he's Madupuela Fadugba, she's Nigerian, Togolese. I mean, there's just incredible things that are happening in Africa. I mean, it's so hard for me to choose, you know, sorry, because I feel I almost want to give justice to everyone. In the Congo, I found some extraordinary photographers. There's so much. I love discovering artists. I mean, you can probably sense that. I love just falling on, you know, these, yeah, great talents. I mean, and Zimbabwe has some incredible painters, for example. Anyways, I could go on and on.
No, it's great. I have been co-hosting this Clubhouse conversation every other Saturday with Sean Green, and one of his kind of go-to questions of our guests is their top five artists. And everyone struggles with it because it changes, right? And who you're most interested in might be who you're working on right now or who you just had a conversation with or the artist that I have one artist who has continued to dog me, who I haven't been able to get to do anything with me. I had three artists who had said no to exhibitions with me over time, and two of them I did get to circle back and do things with, but one of them, I mean, not even a talk, you know, nothing. So sometimes that's the artist that I'll mention, or anyway, it's fluid, it's moving. But I'm interested in what you said, not just about the conversation about how trauma can encourage maybe great art. And there are some aspects of that idea that are problematic, right? Because that implies maybe that certain personal choices or behaviors, you know, should be glorified and things that are self-destructive or whatnot. So it's a difference between like place and self in terms of the impact of trauma. But I think it's hard to separate the art that's being made from the place that it is being made. And it strikes me that you have a really interesting insight into that, having written and reported on not just the art of a place, but also the psyche of a place and the tactical experiences of a place as well. And I don't know if they could ever necessarily be separated, but I'm curious if you feel that one influences the other more. And maybe this is sort of an inherently hopeful question, but what role do you think art can play, I guess, in helping reconstruct things that we'd like to be different?
Yeah, these are questions that I think I'll be exploring or struggling with for a very long time. I don't know if there are actual answers, but I believe as a journalist that you need to use your intuition and your gut, especially in, you know, difficult situations. And I've had to report in some difficult situations, obviously. And you just feel what is right, and you have feelings about people, about places, and maybe I don't go inside here or I stay over here. And I use that now. I really listen to my intuition. And I listen to it in terms of trauma and in terms of answering this question too. And I think art is extremely healing. I think that you know, as a dancer too, I sometimes don't, you know, things that I'm struggling with emotionally, I feel that I can express them through dance or somehow through my body. I can almost heal those emotions. And I think it's the same if you're a painter or, yeah, and you're an artist and, you know, you're struggling. You can't actually maybe theoretically or you can't conceptually process what's happening around you. And so you kind of, you know, your mind is unconsciously processing everything, you know, be it through thoughts or pragmatic thoughts or emotions. So it all comes out on the canvas. And I think I think it's extremely healing. I think everyone should do art, actually. I think the world would be probably a better place if we could kind of all have a creative outlet, because we are creative human beings. I don't think that you're called to be, you know, some people follow, you know, they follow an artistic side, and, you know, their artistic side, other people go in other directions. But I think we all have a creative streak, and it's a great outlet. I do think, yes, it is perhaps a bit bleak to say that trauma creates good art, but it's true. You know, I do think that, you know, I think sometimes in some really difficult situations, you just need to, we don't even know how to scientifically process or explain it, but you're just driven to express yourself. I don't think that you need to be traumatized. You need to be in a war zone to create great art either. You could also just be, I mean, you look at Shakespeare, who had quite a normal life, so to say, but he's, from what we know, we don't know that much, but he created extremely, you know, incredible works of literature that we're still reading today, that still haunt us today. So I think it's a state of mind. It's what the artist goes through. I mean, you look at Jackson Pollock, or you look at some of the, you know, incredible artists in New York or in the West, and they're not necessarily traumatized or going through, you know, war or conflict or suffering, but there might be sort of other things that they're working through that sort of they need to express, you know, through their art. So I just believe art is a vehicle. It is a form of communication. It's a form of documentation. It's not the same as writing or journalism, but it is in some ways taking the zeitgeist, you know, the pulse of the individual, of the artist, but also of the times. I really do believe that. And I believe that at the end of the day, when we all die, what is left, it's the art, you know? And so the art takes the pulse of what's happening around us. And it means that the artist who creates is inherently affected and influenced by his or her surroundings, whether it be, gosh, you know, the sort of the 60s and the free movement, or it could be what we just went through last year between the pandemic, Black Lives Matter. I think we're going to see some really interesting art coming out very soon. And I've spoken to a lot of artists during the pandemic, and some of them have been extremely upset and they have not been able to create art. Then other people have just decided they're just going to throw themselves into creating as much art as possible to process what's around them. It also depends on the financial state that people are in. I think there's some sort of thing that you're working out in order to create your art. I that's my gut. That's what I feel. And that's what I've also witnessed, you know, for over 10 years of reporting on artists and these regions. And we're always working things out. I mean, we don't have, no one is living the, you know, perfect life or the most blissful existence. I mean, otherwise we'd probably all be dead. We're always kind of working or bettering ourselves and exploring. And that's the beauty of being human. The beauty of being human actually is the beauty of being imperfect. And I believe that. And that's art for you. So the Lebanese right now are traumatized. I mean, it is, I experienced that myself right when I left. I mean, there's just this, I mean, I don't even know what it was. I wasn't in the explosion. But that was probably one of the most difficult things I've reported on. I think I almost internalized the trauma myself, and I started questioning. I actually had a mini existential crisis because I wrote so much on it, and I had so many friends. I had friends who died. I had friends who just are traumatized. There's people who've lost their eyes. And I really, at one point I was, you know, I was at a breaking point writing all these stories because I had to internalize the pain in some way to write about it. And I asked myself, maybe I'm not, maybe, you know, do other journalists go through this? But they do. we have to empathize in order to create. But it's through empathy that I think it's through empathy that we can, you know, get to a better state of coexistence with others. So art, I think it's such an important tool for everybody, really. And
there's so many things that you're saying that I really identify with and want to emphasize. And I have a gratitude for being able to share the way you're thinking, you know, with the broad audience. And I really appreciate your acknowledgement of the intuition piece. And maybe it goes back to something we were talking about earlier in terms of the both and thinking that, you know, there's somehow a schism between being able to be both intellectual and emotional, or artistic and scientific, or, you know, whatever it is that maybe we've been told we can't do both, glamorous and rigorous. And I think the intuition piece is really significant and it gets diminished, but that's, I think, how we know what to do. And I think the way something feels in our body, if we give ourselves the time and space to be truthful about that, whether it's an invitation or a space to enter or not, or someone to trust. And to circle back also to that idea of truth and whose truth is it that you feel comfortable accepting? A lot of that has to do with how it feels in your body, and whether that's a combination of something that is physiological or more esoteric, it, I think, can correctly be identified as intuition.
Yeah, I'm very well, I'm so happy that you picked these up, because it's they're thoughts that I'm thinking about all the time these days. Cause I don't know, sometimes I wonder if we trust ourselves enough as human beings, because, you know, we're constantly looking, obviously there's the whole self-help movement, and, you know, this whole pandemic has made a lot of people question and doubt themselves. And we're living in a time of just such uncertainty. But, you know, we've always lived in a time of uncertainty. It's true that things are more uncertain than ever, and we have postponements and cancellations, like there's no tomorrow. I mean, but it's like, you know, it's almost forced everybody to just try, really, really try and appreciate the now and appreciate, you know, the day that you're living, because we really don't know what's going to happen. I think we became so, just took everything for granted. I took it for granted. I was going to, you know, jump on the plane, jump on a business class seat, you know, write my article, lands, go to a dinner. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we lived in this hyper, you know, hyper world, and we still live in a hyper world. I mean, we're living through screens, which is, I find, you know, it is still quite surreal. You know, we have to kind of reflect on that, but it is what we have. And I feel sometimes that we've lost our intuition. We've lost our ability to trust ourselves. You know, people are looking a lot to healers and to, I mean, I not that that's bad. I think that it's fine. Whatever you want to do, whatever feels comfortable is good. But I think if you can stop, if you can listen, if you can, you know, really focus on, yeah, how you're feeling in a certain situation, and just appreciate what's in front of you, whether it be a work of art, how you're responding to it, and how you're responding to it obviously depends on the context that you grew up with. It depends on the context that you're in. It depends on your emotional state. So we, as you're saying, nothing is, everything has a dichotomy. I love the word dichotomy, because again, I love contrasts. And so it's, you know, and that's the beauty of it. You know, the glamorous can be the rigorous. The glamorous can be the edgy, you know, as well. And you, the scientific can also be the intuitive. I think they all go hand in hand. And that's what I love about writing about art. And I always kind of, probably from my political background and my art background, a lot of people are like, oh my goodness, like, how could you have studied, you know, contemporary and modern art and then studied a conflict resolution and political science? And how do you put those two together? But I actually see that they're very similar. Actually, yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah. Why not? And why not use art as a way to document what's happening in a country? You know, I can report. I mean, I've done, you know, quite a few reports on, you know, coronavirus, on news and stuff. But then when you look at what the artists are doing, the artists are already documenting how they feel according to their environment. But we don't always focus, obviously, in a news report or a news article. You're not going to say, I feel this way or I feel this. So you get an extra layer when you look at a work of art, or when you look at what the artist is doing, when you talk to the artist, you know, because artists rarely lie. They can't lie, actually. I feel, I not why well, I want to say can't lie. I mean, I don't, gosh, I don't want to, but it's, you know, a work of art doesn't lie. I mean, the truth, obviously, like I said, is can be subjective, but it's there naked in front of you, and you're going to make of it what you're going to make of it, and the artist is putting into it what he or she wanted to put into it.
Okay, that was amazing. And a friend of mine was a guest on the podcast a while ago, a woman named Patricia Miller, and I didn't know her that well when we did the podcast. And we made it like a walking and coffee date on New Year's Day. That was at like 8 a.m. and spent a couple of hours talking about what our goals and intentions were for the year. And she shared with me this idea that every year on New Year's, she writes almost like the equivalent of what she called like a fortune cookie fortune for herself. So she would take the napkin from wherever she was on New Year's. And then on New Year's Day, she would write out what she wanted to be, you know, her message for the year. And, you know, you could think of that as a mantra or whatever, but I loved that. And I committed to spend that day, New Year's Day, thinking about what mine would be for the year. And so mine for this year is find the truth within. And what you described is exactly that. You know, instead of asking everyone else, you know, what they think you should do, whether it's, you know, an intuitive or a friend, you know, ask yourself, because you actually know.
You always know, you know, but I've had my own, you know, I've self-doubted. I think, you know, people look at, you know, what you're, especially when you're kind of in the public realm, which I happen to be. I mean, I'm very down to earth. I don't need to say down to earth person, but when you work in the media, you are ultimately in the public realm and people look at you and they assume things. But I've self-doubted a lot. And then I, you know, I've thought about it and why I do self-doubt. And I know a lot, everybody does at one point. And we always are searching, we always search outside of ourselves for answers, you know? And I've been thinking a lot about this in relation to my own, you know, art reporting and looking and working with artists, but a lot of the artists actually don't, some of the, you know, or the dancers, sometimes you stop needing to look outside when you're really in tune with your art and with yourself. You stop having to look outside or to ask other people, what should I do for advice? Because you're more in tune with yourself. You feel whole and you trust yourself. And as soon as you have that feeling and you know, and that's your truth. And that's usually when things happen. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. If we can, I don't know how else to put it, but it's quite comforting and it's truthful. It's knowing your own truth. Gosh, I sound like I'm getting into like psychotherapy or something, but it is all art related, but it's, an art in a work of art doesn't lie, and the artist has to have is taking whatever is inside him or her and putting it out there. And you have to believe in yourself. You have to trust yourself in order to put it out there, you know? So if you're having self-doubts, it's actually hard to create a work of art. You know, when you think about it, I've been thinking about that a lot as a dancer, and, you know, it was really difficult to kind of get into class again in the beginning. And I, you know, moving, even though I've danced around my apartment and my house all these years, but going back to class, training your body again, you know, doing tendus and pliés and pirouettes, and, you know, your body starts, you know, picking up a new language, and then you trust yourself, and that's, then you feel whole again, and you don't need answers from the outside, you know, because you have them in you.
So good. Every time I do one of these, I learn something, and it often seems to be exactly, hopefully not just what I need to hear, but what our audience needs to hear too. And I am certain that this idea that art doesn't lie and art can't lie is what's going to be rolling around in my head for definitely all day today, but probably for a while. Rebecca Ann, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and for all of us. I know it's late there and I am the end of a long day for you. And I just have so much gratitude for your honesty and authenticity and generosity.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And thanks so much again.
Be well.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Conversations About Art is part of HiZ.art. This episode was produced by Simon Illa. Our theme music was composed by Eric McDougall. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and review us on whichever platform you listened, as it helps us further our goal of connecting all to art. We will be back again every Tuesday with new episodes. Thanks so much for listening.